Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 87th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Thursday, the 19th of July, 2018, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week, we welcome back Paul Cockshott to the show, where we discuss his 1993 book, Towards a New Socialism. But before all that, I have to thank the new PayPal subscriber, Max B, the once-off PayPal donation of Martinus A, and the new Patreon patrons, Brendan K, Julian K, Christopher C, and Peter H. You too can donate to help to keep the show going by hitting on that there PayPal button or signing up over on Patreon. If you want to leave a comment, please do it on the YouTube channel. I always try and respond to the comments as best as I can. Alternatively, you can email me at alpha2omegapodcast@gmail.com. That's with the number 2. And if you are listening on YouTube, please, please, please hit the subscribe button and give the episode a thumbs up. I also recently appeared on 3 expletive-filled episodes of the Swampside Chats. Go check them mothers out. Lexi of Swampside Chats and myself are planning to do a series of live YouTube hangouts on Professor Kleiman's Reclaiming Marxist Capital. Let me know if you're interested or if you'd like to take part. We'll be getting deep down into the nitty-gritty detail of the TSSI interpretation of Marx's value theory. But now, to the interview. So, Paul, in your book, Towards a New Socialism, was published, God, how long ago is it? Is it 25 years ago now?
Yes, 25 years ago.
So, in that book, you talk about the difficulties that the existing socialist countries had in actually planning the economies, that they were, the complexity of the economies was beyond the ability for societies without computers to be able to do it. For the last 25, 30 years, that type of computational power has existed. Can you talk about how you propose using these new forces of production to plan an economy in a socialist fashion?
There's two aspects to this. One of them is the aspect of how do you have the correct orders placed by the state for all the different types of intermediate goods that enter into production. The goods which are, instead of consumed by final consumers, go to other factories to be made into other things. Now, that is an area where the Soviet system was reaching the limits of manual planning. Because I think they had something like 30,000 controlled commodities for intermediate goods, but that's well below the number of things which are actually produced. Now, what's happened since those days has been, for example, the development of barcodes, universal product codes, so that every product in modern society has a computer identity and can, in principle, be tracked and its numbers quantified. So you can, in principle, overcome one of the big difficulties of the Soviet planning system, which was that it would give target outputs to factories in terms of headings, that certain amount of, I have difficulty thinking offhand of an immediate industrial example, but the sorts of industrial examples people would talk about were steel bars, that they would be given a certain tonnage of steel bars that was the target of the rolling mill. But because they were not divided into sufficient number of diameters of steel bars, the rolling mill is going to turn out its tonnage in whichever diameter of steel bar is easiest, which would tend to be the thickest ones. And you end up with too many thick steel bars and not enough of the lighter ones that are needed for some kind of concrete reinforcement. And this was a chronic problem. And that's basically because when people are drawing up the plan with paper and pencil methods, they can't really take into account, or couldn't in the 1950s and 60s, take into account the huge diversity of products that were beginning to be produced. With universal product codes and computerized stock taking, that problem goes away. You're capable of specifying plans right down to the individual product descriptors. And that happens already in the exchange of information between capitalist firms. It occurs largely in electronic form, and it occurs using standardized descriptors for products. So that kind of technology, which was developed for logistics in the capitalist world, is directly applicable to the socialist world. The other technology which was a precondition for this is the ability to store a lot of information in computers. And basically, that came down to the invention of the computer disk drive. And that really was not, everyone's familiar with computer disk drives now, but they were leading edge technologies in the early 1980s, large capacity disk drives, and were part of the embargoed list of products that were not allowed to be exported to the Soviet Union. So you need to actually have big databases, so build databases that for billions of items, millions of different types of products, and billions of destinations and tracking of all of these. And that required large-scale storage technology, which didn't become available, as I say, till the end of the 80s. Obviously, it is available now. Interestingly, in China, you get a billionaire like Jack Ma, who runs Alibaba, saying the same sort of things as the Soviet computing pioneers were saying. He's saying we now have the technology to move directly to communism in China and get rid of money and do everything by direct allocation and direct calculation. Of course, he has a great deal of experience of that because his Alibaba is the biggest retail system in the world, a computerized retail system. So he knows what he's talking about there.
He's actually saying that.
Oh, yes. They rapidly came down on him to say he shouldn't be making pronouncements about this. It was a matter for the party. I mean, he made those statements last year. And they came down and said, oh, no, it's not up to you to do communism. It's a party matter. Obviously, the party doesn't want to do it. Doesn't want to get rid of money because too many of them are making too much money. Though, obviously, with Z talking about necessity to study Marx, these questions are going to come up again. In the case of consumer goods, any society that is not operating according to a sort of monastic type of communism, where everyone has a fixed set of consumption goods provided to them and everyone lives in monastery type, is going to have some kind of way of allocating goods in proportion to people's choices, because individual needs of individual people differ. A family with young children obviously has a different set of consumption needs from a family with no young children. And people have to be able to adjust what they're getting to their different circumstances in life. And if you just deal with the system of rationing, it's very difficult to adequately deal with that. So that what we propose is derived from the suggestions of Marx, but filled in more detail, which is that people get credits, labor credits, for the amount of time they work. And with these, they're able to withdraw from publicly owned supermarkets goods which require the same amount of time to make them. So there's an equivalence relationship there. It's an equivalence economy with no exploitation taking place. If I work for an hour, I get credits for an hour, and I can withdraw goods which require the same amount of work to make them, which is the proposal Marx makes in Critique of the Gopher Program.
So I think in your book you had some statistics you had calculated from the British National Statistics to calculate the level of exploitation. What was the level of exploitation? Was it like 50% or something?
Well, it depends how you measure it. If you measure it in terms of what percentage of value do people get, the rate is lower, or are you measuring it what percentage of profit is there over their wages? If you Marx expressed it as profit over wages, and in the 90s or in the 70s it was around 50%. It's risen now in Britain to more like 90%. If you get a pound back in wages, 90 pence is going to the as profits. So the point about a transfer to a labour accounting system is that for most people it means a really big increase in their incomes.
That 90% seems kind of too high to me.
That's not 90% of total value. It's the profits on 90 pence in the pound of wages. Close to that. I would have to look at the latest calculations for that. But that's the sort of ratio Marx obtained in Victorian Britain, operating in the cotton mills of the 19th century.
So are you saying that wages, say if wages in the economy is a billion, profits are 900 million?
Yes, yes. Close to 100% exploitation rate, yes. This is what was assumed in Capital, and it has been argued is the natural state of a capitalist economy, that the capitalists end up taking half the product. Whether that's true or not is, I think, dependent on all sorts of other factors, but it's certainly what's tending to be the case in Britain at the moment. I don't have up-to-date enough figures in my head for other countries to tell you that.
So getting back to this computational exercise then, how would we go about then planning this economy now that we have our barcodes?
Well, you have to first divide an economy into things which are collective and individual consumption. Collective consumption is things like education, healthcare, free roads and public transport. Things like that have to be decided by some democratic process. So there has to be some democratic process which decides how much is going to be spent on this. But in order to decide how much, you have to have some unit in which it's decided. So it has to be decided in terms of time. How much of the population's time is going to be spent providing healthcare? How much of the population's time is going to be providing education? And there has to be some kind of democratic vote on this. So one of the things that subsequent to writing the book we did was investigate how could you use modern technology to allow democratic voting on major budgetary decisions like that. And we prototyped a system whereby you could have votes by mobile phone on these issues. So the major budget headings, you could decide whether you wanted to increase the amount of social effort which went into healthcare by 5%, reduce it 5%, leave it the same. And by giving people choices that are small, marginal choices, but by aggregating them over the whole population, you can work out what the collective intention is for the adjustment to social labour for publicly owned goods. And for publicly owned goods, then, the organisations like the health service, the education services, the social care would be given manpower budgets. And it's up to them how they're going to use these manpower budgets, either directly as employees or indirectly in terms of products of other industries, so that if a hospital has got a manpower budget, some of that would go on the people that are actually working there, but some of it is going to go on the supplies of drugs and medical equipment, etc. That implies a certain proportion of the population working to provide medicines, a certain proportion of the population working to provide medical equipment, etc. So that is how you deal with the non-individual consumption. Individual consumption would go through the existing system that you have with supermarkets at the moment and the existing stock control system that they have, except that this would then turn into forming plan objectives for the planning system, which is to produce a certain mix of consumer goods corresponding to what is currently being sold in the supermarket.
So the idea was that the broad populace decides generally on the overall spending in different categories. Defence should be 2%, health should be 21%, you know, environment should be 11%, energy should be 30%, whatever.
Yes.
When those plans break down, say the energy sector gets 20% to spend, how is the detailed
plan? Well, you'd only have to do that for energy if energy was going to be distributed free, which is not necessarily a good political decision. You have to do this for everything that's going to be distributed free.
Okay, and what are you doing for things that aren't distributed free? We're saying it's all just consumption.
Well, you don't get rid of income tax. You're still going to have an income tax. So that people are paid for the hours they work, but they still have to pay income tax on that. And the reason you need democratic budgetary voting is that the allocation of resources for social services have got to come out of people's income tax.
Yeah, okay, let me be more specific then with my question. Say in the case of the health system, where it's coming out of general taxation.
Yeah.
How do they decide how to break down that spending? Or what level of democratic control is there on, say, what it is we're going to spend in the health service?
Well, I'm not an expert on medical service planning, so I wouldn't want to say too much on that, other than saying that in general, you would want this to be under the control largely of the people who are actually medical people rather than professional managers. You would want the final decision on it to be made by medical staff with some kind of overall public representation on the health boards in different areas.
Are you saying then at a lower level we will have experts deciding on it with input also from people and not just expert-led decision-making?
I mean, I've not really thought of what the appropriate structure for the health service would be, but if I apply general principles we advocate elsewhere, you would say that there would be health service councils which would be drawn from nurses and doctors and from some proportion from the general population, and drawn at random preferably. And these people would have to decide on the overall objectives of which section types of healthcare get which proportions of the healthcare budget. You can't devolve the whole thing on the whole population because it's too complicated.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's always going to be some level of abstraction. But let's say, for example, we take a random sample of 1,000 people, 500 working in the medical centre, 500 are plebs like myself, and we sit down and we start deciding.
1,000 is too many. You would never get a...
Let's say 100. I was just thinking of a decent sample size.
Yes.
That's why I was thinking of 1,000. Let's say 100. And let's say they come up with a plan 1 year for 10% this and 15% that. And then the next year you get 100 different people and their plans are quite different. How do we control for, say, continuity in investment?
Well, people are sensible. Firstly, if you're unlikely to get widely differing opinions from one period to the next, because you're drawing them from the same population of people, unless something really drastic has occurred, like, you know, an outbreak of black death or something, where people think, oh God, why weren't we investing in bubonic plague vaccines? The people aren't going to change their opinions dramatically. The times when they change their opinions dramatically will be when there genuinely is a need to respond to something.
Fair enough. No, I'm just trying to get out the nitty-gritty. So let's get back then to you were saying about we were going into consumer goods and planning for consumer goods.
Consumer goods, let's go back a bit. Back in the 1950s, the Soviet economist Kantorovich showed that if you have what he called a planned target, which was basically a mixture of consumer goods that the economy is due to produce, you can apply purely mathematical computerized techniques to decide which is the optimal way to produce as much as possible of that mix of consumer goods. But for the plan to work, you need this plan target. Now, some of the plan target can be provided by decisions taken by democratic bodies, like we've just been deciding. You want to have so many hospital beds. You want to have so many school places. Others, when it comes down to consumer goods mixes, have got to come from what people are spending their labor tokens on. And by monitoring the stock control systems of all the supermarkets, you know what the adjustments you need to make to consumer goods output is. So it's possible to have a pretty much close to real-time adjustment of the plan, whereas the original Soviet system required planning to be far in advance, you know, on a five-year timescale, which meant it wouldn't respond that rapidly to adjustments in consumer demand. Whereas with modern technology, you can adjust it much more rapidly. You still, however, have to plan some things far in advance. If you consider the major challenge facing industrial civilization at the moment, which is to shift from the use of fossil fuels to non-fossil energy sources. That has huge implications in terms of not only what kind of energy do we produce, but what kind of transport systems we use, what kind of building materials we use, what kind of construction materials we have. And that is in terms of major structural changes to the economy, which has got to be planned over 20, 30 years. So some of those things can't come just from observing consumer goods trends. They have to come from the political system of society democratically deciding how it's going to shift to a new mode of material production. And that is the sort of thing that even the old Soviet-style planning was best at, planning major structural changes to the economy. And I don't think people are aware of just how many implications there are of shifting from fossil fuel to non-fossil fuel. For instance, if you look at any city in the developing world or modern cities in the developed world, what are they built of? Steel, concrete, and to a lesser extent, brick. Now, all of those are very intensive in the use of carbon dioxide. You can't process steel without having carbon to reduce the iron oxide in the steel or in the iron ore. You can't produce concrete without heating the calcium carbonate in limestone and releasing carbon dioxide. You can't produce bricks except by you make bricks at the moment is to mix clay with coal dust and put them in a kiln, and the coal dust burns and heats the brick up, which is why the center of the bricks are black. Now, all of these are really carbon-intensive processes. So you have to start planning for a housing system, which is not going to be the way it is now. There's a whole set of environmental objectives here, which require you to decide well in advance how the entire structure of industry is going to be set up.
This is interesting. How would you make these long-term decisions that would then feed into, say, all of these plans? Say you have this current problem, you want 25 years time all buildings to be made, say, from bamboo or whatever the hell it's going to be. How does that feed into our investment decisions democratically?
Well, the key factor is that you actually have to have decisions about what is to be produced settled by politics, by public decision, rather than by the short-term calculations of firms as to what is going to be their profit-maximizing strategy. Because profit-maximizing strategy does not take into account environmental concerns at all, because the environment isn't a source of money, it doesn't enter into the calculations. So that you have to shift to a premise that what is produced is going to be produced according to long-term planning as to what's going to be sustainable. Now, how you actually organize the planning bureaus to do that, on the one hand, it isn't for me to say the very details of it, but we know that it's not that difficult, because even capitalist countries have been able to achieve that kind of planning in wartime very quickly, when the structure of national output has over 2 or 3 years been radically changed in order to meet national objectives. If the impetus is there, it's not difficult to do. I'm sure that given the political will, it could readily be done.
Okay, so for example, there could be a decision to have a national debate on, for example, re-greening the economy, and, you know, a 1 year debate is put into effect and people come up with then 30-year plans that are implemented over the long haul on top of these individual year plans, and is pushed through.
Yes, you have to. You when you're calculating what is going to be available for consumption, you have to take into account some prior idea of how much you're going to have to invest just to make society sustainable.
People don't realize, like, not very many people are alive from the Second World War anymore, but I think young people would be surprised to learn that I think in America, all the car factories didn't produce any new cars for, I think, 6 years, and they just retooled them and made planes and tanks instead. You know, that when societies want to do things like this, they can do it actually extremely rapidly. And it's not a technical problem. It's usually a political problem.
It's overwhelmingly a political problem, yes. And it's a problem of the redeployment of people from their existing activities and comfortable activities to what becomes necessary in an emergency. You can't think that society is going to be able to have its existing distribution of jobs and labour power as it restructures itself to deal with this crisis. Lots of people are going to have to be retrained and moved to different activities.
Very good. So can we get into these big input-output tables and let us know what the hell they're about?
Okay, well, an input-output table is something that most countries with good statistical agencies publish. And it's like, looks like a spreadsheet. And you have a grid with columns which are listed in terms of industries. So typically they always start with agriculture, then forestry, then fishing, and then food processing. So they'll have maybe 100 different columns for the 100 main industries in the country. And they have 100 rows, again, listed by the industries. And the cells, which form the intersection of the rows and columns, say, for example, how much of the output of the forestry industry goes into the plywood industry? How much of the output of the forestry industry goes into the paper industry? So they list the relative flows between the different industries. And these are a basic tool for doing any economic planning. Because if you decide, for example, that in Britain you are going to reduce the number of people working in financial services and increase the number of people working in alternative energy production, you have to look at what the follow-on effects in other industries are. And an input-output table helps you follow this through. Because you see, if we're going to increase the output of windmills, we're going to have to increase the output of aluminium, because a lot of aluminium is used in the windmill. You're also going to have to increase the output of fiberglass and polyurethane, because those are used to make the blades. All these things can be captured in a sufficiently detailed input-output tables. The input-output tables published for Britain are relatively low detail. The Soviet Union had much more detailed ones. And you need these for doing the planning in order to project through what the impacts of changing one industry is on all the other industries.
So these big input-output tables, currently you might have one, say, used by, say, the Treasury, are quite small, aggregated into large industries. But we would propose a massive planning tables, input-output tables, down to the very individual products. So we, in a modern capitalist economy, how many products do we have today? Is it in the, I think it may be in the billions of different products. Am I correct in saying that?
I don't know how many. I'm not up to date with the current ones. The last time I saw statistics for this was that the Soviet Union was estimated to have 10 million. You can get some sort of rough idea is that each product generally requires several people to make it. So the number of products is going to be somewhat less than the number of employees. So you can get some sort of order of magnitude from that.
Okay, so we're probably into the hundreds of millions. So we have these big, massive tables that are basically like matrices if people do their mathematics in school or whatever. Big, massive, and you know, if you were to write it out, it would cover a few football pitches. We have them in computers now. And what's the technical?
Yes, but you don't actually write them out.
I know that. I'm joking. Yeah.
I mean, you get them print. You can get printed copies of the disaggregated ones. And I actually used to have one on my wall. I can't remember, in an office, I think, for the Scottish input output table. It came to a lot. You know, it was about an A0 table. Basically, they would be stored on in computer form and used to do what if scenarios. If you decide to increase one industry by, or a certain bunch of industries, what is the implications for manpower resources in the rest of the economy? Because in a capitalist economy, there's almost always a surplus of labor power. And that's there in order to keep wages down. But in a socialist economy, you don't have any unemployment, which means that if you are going to shift the economy from doing one thing for another, the key thing is the reallocation of people. And you have to start saying how many people are we going to have to move between one activity and another. And you can derive that from the input-output table, because the input-output table tells you how many people are needed in each industry to produce the current output.
So say, for example, you decide as a society to, say the Britain economy, say they decide to stop offshore oil production and to build a tidal power station in the Severn or something like this. And they look at what would the impact be and how many people they'd have to move and would they need to build new houses here and et cetera, et cetera. And you can see how it would play out and what the true cost of maybe switching from one to the other would be.
Yes. I mean, the true costs are always a cost in terms of what people are going to have to shift to doing. And what it's going to cost consumers in that case is you can see whether you can afford to still have the same number of people producing consumer goods or whether you'll need less.
Would there not also be an investment, like a dead investment cost, if you have built houses near the North Sea and now you decide you need a whole load of new houses in West Wales or somewhere? Is there not also that other cost?
There is that, yes. Decide whether it's going to be better to prefabricate the components for the, let's say, the tidal power station up in the in where they built the oil rigs at Nigg and then shift them, for example. So that kind of issue can come up. But that kind of planning is already done by the state in limited areas. I said that during the war, the economy was planned in order to produce weapons. Even now, when the British state wants to produce a major weapons system, it has to engage in fairly comprehensive planning so that when it decided to produce aircraft carriers and hadn't been producing aircraft carriers for 40 or 50 years, they actually got the RAND Corporation to do a plan for the industrial resources of the country, whether the industrial resources of the country could sustain it, whether how many new apprentices were going to have to be taken on in the shipbuilding industry, which parts of the shipbuilding industry could be used, etc. So this kind of planning is done by the state when it needs to and can readily be done if there's a political directive for doing it. The example of this happening last time, really, that is non-military, was the decision in the 1950s to shift energy production from oil to nuclear power, which was taken after the Suez Crisis. They decided very rapidly to develop a nuclear power industry and succeeded in doing that in about 10 years. So these decisions, if they're taken, can be achieved quite quickly.
Okay, so can we talk then about the technical problems associated with these big old input-output tables and trying to process them?
Well, from a computing standpoint, it's not a difficult problem using input-output analysis. It's the solution to simultaneous linear equations. And although you've got millions of equations, each equation has a relatively limited number of variables. In other words, if I say I'm going to produce yogurt, well, yogurt is going to require milk, and it's going to require plastic, and it's going to require aluminium foil for the tops, and it's going to require some equipment in the yogurt factories. But on the other hand, it's not going to require a whole lot of textiles. It's not going to require a whole lot of semiconductors. So if you look at the whole output of the economy, only a very small share of it is used to produce each individual product. So these input-output tables are mostly blanks. If you disaggregate them into more and more detail, more and more of the cells in your input-output table don't contain anything because one industry is not actually connected to another. Now, here we come to the results from what may seem an obscure branch of mathematics. And I wasn't aware of this until I consulted with colleagues who know more about it, that there's a theorem by Erdős that if you were to have a connected graph, and by graph in mathematics we mean a system of circles with arcs or lines joining them. If you're to have a fully connected graph, the ratio between the number of nodes in the graph and the number of arcs between them is such that the nodes will in general have to have arcs coming out which are proportional to the logarithm of the number of nodes. So it's this is what's known as an n log n relationship. And you can view an economy as a graph, with each industry being a node in the graph, and an interconnection between two industries being an arc. Now, the Erdős theorem says that if the economy is to be fully connected, that is to say, that such that you could not split the economy into two completely discrete economies which didn't interact with one another, then you expect at least this n log n relationship to hold in terms of interconnectivity. Now, why is the n log n relationship important? It's because it enormously reduces the complexity of the equations you have to solve. If you have 10 million, or let's say a million products, a million nodes, and you take log to the base 10 of that, and log to the base 10 of that is only 6. So an n log n relationship for solving a million equations says that you only have 6 million variables to actually solve. And therefore, the 6 million terms is much easier to deal with than a million million terms, which you'd get in the completely fully populated table.
Yeah, if every product contained a bit of everything else, you would have a million million, so an old-fashioned billion, what did a quadrillion equations versus 6 million?
Yes, so it gets worse and worse the bigger the economy gets. It grows as the problem of solving it actually grows as n to the power of 3, whereas you can show that you can get very good answers in order n log n because of this sparsity. I mean, all this is a diversion into graph theory, but
it's an interesting way to visualize the economy, though, of nodes with connectors, with like arrows going to different nodes.
Well, that's much closer to how you would actually store it on a computer. You wouldn't store it as a huge table. That becomes a very inefficient way to store it. You'd store it as a graph structure.
So it's interesting because in your book, you were talking about how you have these massively empty matrix.
Yes.
You know, I remember I did a maths degree and did numerical analysis courses, and some of the techniques you were talking about, I haven't heard them in about 25 years, but you have these like Gauss-Seidel methods. You don't have to solve all the equations. You can break it out. And
you wouldn't use Gauss-Seidel. You'd use Jacobi solution.
Sorry, I forget the names. I'm just... I'm getting the wrong names, but the names were so familiar to me, and I forgot exactly what they were actually were. It's interesting, you know, like this type of idea that we read from the right wing, even still to this day, about why a communist planning couldn't work, you know, technically is a very well-known and solved problem at this stage.
Well, the technical solutions were worked out by Soviet mathematicians. They just didn't get the computing resources from the Politburo they needed to do it.
So like a combination at this stage, you know, from if we look back, say, 100 years ago, the arguments of von Mises and Hayek and these guys, they have been theoretically solved, and the forces of production element has been solved too.
They were theoretically solved by Kantorovich in the late 30s, except that the Austrian school never scarcely recognized that Kantorovich even existed. The technical ability to do it came from the 1980s onwards. Kantorovich was able to solve it on a smaller scale. He was able to apply it to the Soviet oil and energy industry, which is what he had the resources to solve the equations.
So in the book, you mentioned somewhere that Marx and Engels had said there could be problems using labour value for prices. What was their objection?
Well, their objection was not to its use as such, but they said you can't have a system of circulating labour tokens because they'll end up being no different from actual cash, and you'll replicate all the relationships that you get in a capitalist economy in the end. So that even if we were to overprint all our banknotes with the amount of hours that a pound represents, you could do that as a short-term measure. But Engels said that if you did that, it would be countless seditious propaganda under Bismarck's Anti-Socialist Act, because it would show every worker how much they were being cheated by seeing that what their wages were compared to the amount of work they were putting in. In the long term, he says, you can only do it if you have tokens which are no more money, as Marx put it, than theatre tickets. That is to say, if you get a theatre ticket, it doesn't circulate. You can use it to go to the theatre, but you can't use it for anything else. So the key thing has to be that these are certificates, he says. He doesn't call them tokens. They're certificates, which say how much work you've done and what you as a person are entitled to withdraw. Now, if you think of it in 19th century technology, it would have been something like a passbook or savings account book, that you worked in the socialist factory and you had your hours credited to that, and you took that to the co-op stores and you could have the same amount of goods withdrawn from it. It would have to work by paper and pencil methods. Nowadays, of course, you can use smart cards for it. You get credited with it. You use the same kind of smart card technology you use currently in shops without having to change that, except that the only way you can get credits into your account is actually by working against the software, so that no interpersonal transfers are... That kind of thing is readily doable with the technology we've got at the moment. So I said that there were two technologies which had been key. One of them was product coding. The other was the large storage disk drive. The third one is smart card technology, which enables you to get rid of paper money or passbooks. Incidentally, that idea was pioneered by Bellamy, the American socialist, who wrote in the 1880s a novel, Looking Backwards. And he was the first person to actually suggest the idea of a credit card. In his suggestion, you'd get a punched card, like a Hollerith card, which had just been invented. And you would take this to the communal stores. And he viewed these communal stores as being something like a cross between Argos and Amazon in the modern world. You would choose the things you wanted, and they would then punch holes in your credit card to make sure you couldn't reuse those credits. But the credits didn't circulate. They were just wiped out. They became chads in the waste bin. He assumed that you would then get the things delivered to you by pneumatic tubes, which went to everyone's house. So you went home and everything was delivered by pneumatic tubes. So he was foreseeing not only the credit card, but the Amazon delivery system and the Argos-type shop in the 1880s, which is quite impressive for a socialist.
On one of your videos where you talk about, you know, the planning and stuff, did you say in one of the videos, and I haven't been able to find it, and I was a bit puzzled if I heard it right, was that the law of value would still operate?
Yes, it has to operate, because the law of value is an expression of the necessity of a society to carry out a proportional distribution of labour time.
Say that again now. What do you mean by that?
Well, all societies have got a finite number of people available to them, and the people only work for a finite amount of time each day. So the basic resource they have is the time of its population. And that population's time has to be distributed between different activities. Now, in a capitalist society, this distribution of human time is made apparent in an alienated form of the prices of commodities. But any society still has to take into account the necessity to distribute its labor force correctly. And this is the underlying basis for the law of value. That's why Marx says all this claim about the necessity for him to prove the law of value is nonsense, because everyone knows that society's got to distribute its labor time in that way. And if the distribution of labor time becomes, in a commodity-producing society, seriously out of line with the price of the products produced, you end up with a portion of society no longer able to reproduce itself, because not enough time flows back to it for it to survive from the time it puts in. But that more generally expresses itself in a socialist economy as well, and you can see it particularly critically in cases like Poland in the right through from the 1950s, when Poland had a large part of its population engaged in peasant agriculture. And peasant agriculture is relatively inefficient. Therefore, you require a lot of people to produce a given amount of product. Now, taken to its conclusion, that would mean that the price of food ought to be high. But because it was a government that grew out of the workers' movement, it did not want high food prices in the shops, in the towns. Therefore, repeatedly, almost because it's subsidized, food was sold below its value. Now, if you sell food below its value, the purchasing power of the working class in going into the shops to buy food will exceed the amount of food that could conceivably be delivered by the inefficient labour of the peasants. So that the amount of labour time equivalent in zlotys that were being handed out to workers from the state exceeded the amount, if they spent it on food, it exceeded the amount of food that the then agricultural technology could have supplied them with. So the food shops sold out. If you went in the 80s, food shops were empty. Not because people weren't eating, but because of the disproportion between value and the price.
I thought the law of value was supposed to be something that was specific to capitalism. As in, we wouldn't say the law of value applied in the feudal society. What you're saying, is it not a kind of a very different type of operative law than, say, the one that Marx describes in Capital?
It depends what you mean, because people who are talking about it are often rather vague about it.
The idea of the decisions about how production is decided in a capitalist society is often driven through competition and those forces.
Correct.
And not through the democratic process of deciding what our priorities are and where we put stuff. And so the capitalist law of value, about how it apportions where production is going and how it disciplines labour and all that kind of stuff, that would not be applying under your one. But what you're saying, so that would be to me like not the law of value, because it's slightly different, but you are making decisions on pricing the goods in the right way.
It depends what you mean by the law of value. I mean, people tend to be vague on this. One way of saying that law of value is to say that if goods appear as commodities, they have to exchange in ratios proportional to their labour time. Now, in that sense, the law of value would have applied in feudal society, and it would have applied in slave societies as well. Insofar as these societies produce commodities, the commodities would tend to exchange in proportion to their labour time. You can tell this by looking at, for instance, the relatives of gold and silver in the Roman Empire, and you see that it doesn't much differ from more modern times, which is only explicable in terms of silver requiring a lot less labour to extract from the mines. So the law of value is still applying, even though the mines are being operated by slaves in both the gold and the silver mines. So it applies. How does it make itself manifest? If all goods were distributed in a traditional fashion, in an unvarying fashion, in the way that Marx describes occurring in Indian communities, village communities in the 18th century, where there's a traditional commodity distribution of goods, you can say there, well, the law of value is not evident as exchange value at all, because the distribution of labour is governed by caste and is not flexible. The people aren't able to change from one activity to another because caste rules prevent it. But over time, the society still has to balance the proportions of the different castes to the potential jobs that there are to do, given the level of technology there. It will express itself as a very slow process of the change in the proportion of the population in different castes due to different differential survival of children in different castes. But it'll still come through, but very slowly, by a different mechanism. But the law of the proportional distribution of labour time still applies. It just doesn't apply as a quantitative relationship between commodities. There was a big debate about this in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, about what the law of value meant and what abstract labour time meant.
Is this when Stalin came out and said the law of value should apply?
No. It went much before that. When Stalin said that, he was just expressing the view of one group of Soviet economists. There had been a debate about this, about what labour was and what abstract labour was, what value was, in the 1920s. In the English language literature, until recently, we've only had one side of the debate, the Rubin side of the debate. since Rubin's book on values was translated into English. Recently, some of the articles on value by people from the other side of the debate have started to appear. I on my blog post, I've got a post on abstract labor and socialism, which is an article from one of Rubin's opponents, written in 1926. The debate in the West on what abstract labor is and what value is, it has been heavily influenced by which things have got translated from the Russian. I went with Alan Cottrell to the archives of the Soviet Studies Department in Glasgow University about 3 years ago to try and dig out some of these different views. Unfortunately, although I can't read Russian, Alan can read Russian, but the articles were all transferred to microfilm, and the microfilm had degenerated so much, you know, since the 1920s that they were practically unreadable and we couldn't do it. But obviously printed copies of these journals still exist in Russia, and in due course they'll be translated.
Well, that's very interesting. We hear a lot of stuff on the kind of radical Marxist left talking about the law of value and how we need to abolish it in any kind of a radical alternative. So it's like interesting to hear what that would mean and what do people mean by that, or even if they do mean something different than you do, because it seems like what you're saying is, I would think, sensible and correct.
Well, you see, some people, you get complete nonsense talked about this, that in under socialism there'll be no abstract labor, only concrete labor. Which implies that there can't actually be a division of labor, because as soon as you have a division of labor, what are you dividing? You're not dividing concrete labor, you're dividing labor in general. In fact, it's arguable that it's under socialism that abstract labor is most attained, because in past societies, all sorts of obstacles existed to people moving from one profession to another. I mean, most obvious is the caste system. Inhibited movement between professions. But then racial and sexual prejudices inhibit the movement of people between professions. That persists under capitalism, so that, in fact, socialism is in a better position to realize abstract labor than capitalism is, because capitalism is still tied to the prejudices of the past. There is an attempt to present abstract labor as something specifically capitalist. Some economists say abstract labor only exists in a capitalist economy, and they say that because what do they actually mean by abstract labor? These economists mean by abstract labor just the monetary price of something. So that it's actually a backwards first account, whereas they're saying that it's the monetary price is the abstract labor. The Marxist theory is the other way around, that it's the abstract labor that determines the monetary price, and abstract labor has an independent existence. And Marx gives two sort of accounts. One of them is that it's the expenditure of human physiological energy, irrespective of what activity it's in. Because any labor requires you to use your muscles and use your brain power, which uses up human physiological energy. So it's one account of it is it's energetic. His other account is that it is abstract labor is fractions of the social working day of the whole population. So it counts as abstract because it is a particular fraction of society's labor. The energetic aspect is a little weak in the modern world, where so much of the directly physical labor is carried out by powered machinery. But the fraction of the social working day aspect is certainly still true. And in this aspect, in that interpretation, abstract labor obviously has to exist in any society, because it would only cease to exist if we were something like termites and born to do one thing and unable to shift to another. But we're not. We can learn things and we can shift between activities. Skills are all, because they're all learned, it's because of that that labor is the one universal resource society has, and that's why it ends up dominating the valuation of everything. Now, that's not going to go away. People are still going to have this potential to learn any skill and move to any activity, and society is still going to have to calculate how many person hours can we afford to spend in different activities? So that doesn't go away. I'm actually unable to make any sense of people saying there's no abstract labour, except, well, sorry, I can't make any sense of it at all, I'm afraid.
So it would mean, you know, if there was not any abstract labour, it would mean nearly a return to primitivism on some level. It would mean that your labour is not being compared to anybody else and essentially nearly leads to this idea of it's for your own personal use.
Well, it would either have to be labour for your own personal use, or it would have to be a reversion to a caste system where you're born as a tanner, or you're born as a dung collector, or you're born as a farmer.
Why would it reverse to that?
Well, I mean, that's the only circumstance where there is only concrete labour, where a society where you can't separate a general ability to work from the work. That a person, that the task is associated with a category of people.
Okay, and it's not an abstract thing. It's like a defined by your birthright.
Yes.
So what we've come to the conclusion then that what you are proposing for this, the type of communism society you're proposing in this, is that a law of value operates, but not the capitalist law. It operates somewhat differently. The dynamics of it are slightly different. But we're making the case that the law of value and how it operates is necessary for the society to figure out what is the best way to go about designing and doing the things that we as a society determine are our objectives.
Yes, I mean, the point is that if you have a planned economy, the abstract labour ceases to take on the mystified form of money. And instead, people directly talk about the amount of time, amount of people you can afford to allocate to different tasks. Well, in the end, it always comes down to the number of people who are going to be doing different tasks each day. That's just a dimension effect, because labor is person hours, but you're talking about person hours per year, so it comes down to persons.
So there's a lot of stuff in your book. I struggle to talk about it all. There's so much stuff. There's detail in there about marketing and about the feedback mechanisms from the market feedback into planning. I would go so far as to say a lot of these things are similar types of solutions applied to different problems.
I'm not quite sure what you're saying there.
Well, because you had a number of different algorithms for different planning types.
Well, we have algorithms for adjusting prices to consumption. We have algorithms for we give different planning algorithms that you could use. We're not saying you have to use one or the other. The point is, we give two different ways you could work it out. And there are known in the initially the Soviet and other mathematical literature, at least three other approaches. The point was just to demonstrate that it's doable using known mathematical techniques. Since we wrote the book, I've known of more techniques which I didn't know of at the time.
Is there anything you would change in the book from what you've written subsequently?
No, the basics. I mean, I've completed another book which is due to come out at some point when Monthly Review get back in touch with me. In that one, I say that there is very little that the last 25 years have taught me to change my views on what we said in that. There's some updating of algorithms, some updating of technologies would obviously be the case. But the basic ideas, I think, are I would still hold to them.
So you're not planning for the reintroduction of the teletext?
That kind of thing, obviously, you would change, yes. Because since then, we've got the internet. It wasn't available in 1992 or so.
I know, I was joking. You know, it was quite quaint. It was like kind of quaint reading back, and you're talking about how to plan stuff on the teletext. You know, it was kind of a blast from the past.
Yes.
You also have a lot of stuff in there about the idea of the commune. This is like an idea that even the radical left has largely dropped from the discourse. Would you like to talk a little bit about your ideas on that?
Well, it's clear that if you go back to when communism started in the 19th century, people were assuming that it didn't just mean public ownership of industry. It meant actually living differently. It meant, if you read the demands in the Communist Manifesto, they call for the building of great palaces in the countryside, which would combine industrial and agricultural work. So it wasn't limited to the idea that you'd take the land into public ownership. They were ambitious about this. They wanted the workers to live in great palaces. And if you look at, you can see, if you look at the illustrations produced by the Owenites, what these palaces were going to be. They were going to be, as they say, palatial style buildings with combined living, working, education facilities built into them. So that you can't expect to completely change society to this immediately, but you should be ambitious. You should be thinking there can be different ways of living. You could set up communities which combine industry and agriculture in the countryside so that people are not having to live in polluted cities and have to travel through public transport to work, but could live near their work. And you could have considerable improvement in people's social life if they lived closer together and that there was some degree of shared responsibility for looking after children, that people grew up in a community rather than isolated. These are the sorts of things that the communists were talking about when it was set up as an idea. They were things which were experimented with to an extent in the countryside in China. They were things that were experimented with a bit in Soviet urban planning. And what we're basically saying is you should be ambitious about this. You shouldn't assume that the family structure and housing structure created by capitalism is something that's going to persist forever, that people will always live in isolated family houses rather than in alternative community styles of living, and that we should be much more ambitious. And you, if you're going to think you're going to break down the sexual division of labour, it's unlikely that you can succeed in doing that entirely in terms of the existing family structure we have. You have to actually think of how can society's family relations change? Will you still have, for instance, the patriarchal marriage system where people are take their names from their fathers? Why should it, as a society, have the male role models be fathers rather than mothers' brothers? Other societies have mothers' brothers as their examples. People are very narrow in their conception of the future. They take just the immediate past as their guide rather than the varieties of human society that have existed.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I was looking at some research and I cannot for the life of me remember where I was looking at it, but it was on the structure of Irish villages, say like 1,000 years ago before the British colonized Ireland. And apparently the rural Irish villages that people actually used not to live on the land. They used to live in villages, and what they would do is they would then walk out to the land to work and come back in the evenings. It was a lot more communal living style, whereas nowadays people live on isolated houses on their land. You know, it reduces the communal aspect of, say, rural living. It was an interesting thing. I never ever heard about that before.
Well, it must have been much the same when on the Scottish coast when people were living in brochs. You know what they are?
What is that now? That sounds like a Gaelic word, but I don't know that one.
Brochs are, there are a few of them still surviving. They're
like a crannog.
Not a crannog. Crannog would be another example. Brochs came later. Brochs are Bronze Age. They are huge buildings, circular usually. They look rather like the cooling tower of a power station in shape. And apparently whole communities lived in these huge stone buildings. Now, have a look on your on Google for B-R-O-C-H. They're spread along the coast of Scotland.
Yeah, I'm sure they were probably in Ireland as well. The crannog is the one I'm used to. It's a kind of one that was built on stilts on a lake. I think are the ones.
They were built on stilts on the lake, and on if there weren't lakes around, people lived in brochs.
It's interesting. I think that idea of like radical reorganization of the family unit is something that I think appeals. Like I live in, myself and my partner, we live with the child here in London, and we don't have relatives near us, and so we end up having very little kind of, you know, you don't have the same support. And the work involved in childcare is exponentially increased.
Yes.
You know, in the modern society, certainly in places like London, the school is essentially used for childcare. It's not really education. I think at least as much of it is childcare.
Well, yes, my eldest is just about to leave school, but I know that the sort of worry you get as the summer holidays approach, because you don't have the resources to both work and look after them.
So thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Okay then. Cheerio.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and Antonis Karas with the theme tune from The Third Man. Thank you for listening. Please join me in the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.